Holly Kent Payne is one of the leaders of Anti-War Committee Chicago. She helped organize the Midwest Action Against Drones and participated in the march against NATO. Everyone give it up for Holly. Nice to see you all here today. So, first of all, I have a question for you guys. Where is the U.S. waging war today?
Everywhere.
Okay, so you guys have an answer. That's good. But this answer is not necessarily common knowledge, nor is it easily ascertained. So 10 years ago, we could have easily said Iraq. 40 years ago, we could have said Vietnam. But today, what can we really say in the absence of a large-scale invasion and occupation being sold to the public as America's war? Even those of us in the anti-war movement have kind of struggled with this question, although we do know from decades of experience that the United States does not make peace. It negotiates deals, it beats tactical retreats, or it suffers defeat. But it doesn't make peace. So the military budget grows steadily every year, although it has suffered a lot of cutbacks since the 2008 recession, but it's still growing. And it's also the largest portion of our annual budget. Yet many people still retain the idea that Obama is a peaceful president, in contrast to the warmonger Bush, who we all hate. But while he may have scaled back the involvement in the wars that he inherited from Bush, Iraq and Afghanistan, Obama and his administration have also murdered civilians in Yemen, Pakistan, Syria, and Somalia in the continuing war on terror. So let's compare Bush and Obama with a couple of numbers. Bush launched 48 drone strikes in Pakistan. Obama launched 328. Bush authorized only one drone strike in Yemen, while Obama signed off on over 100. While retaining the appearance of a peaceful and diplomatic leader, Obama has still continued to pursue American dominance of the globe using the blunt edge of its military power. Yet that edge remains somewhat hidden from his subjects, submerged beneath new covert methods of war-making. For example, the recent refugee crisis in Europe has caused an upsurge of outrage against the U.S. for not doing more to take in refugees. But far from being uninvolved in Syria, the U.S. has been training and arming fighters there for the last 2 years and has recently escalated the involvement with airstrikes against ISIS. So we're involved, but somehow most Americans do not think that we are really at war in Syria. And why not? Well, because it is not in the interest of America's rulers to popularize the idea of our direct involvement in this or in any other war. And why not? Well, partly because of the way the American public turned so harshly against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and before that, Vietnam. So gone are the days of the glorious patriotic wars of ideas. Fighting communism and terror with American boots on the ground led to years of casualties and quagmire, as our occupying forces met with brave and determined resistance, until eventually we had to declare retreat. Of course, we never admit defeat, but I think we all know what happened. The presidents who led these wars were defeated, and so were their parties. So it's clear now that mass invasion is no longer a viable strategy for empire building. In the new era of war making, war is not defined by boots on the ground or our flags on the soil. Changing conditions require a change in tactics, and the new tactics are proxy armies, puppet governments, drones, smart weapons, democratic revolutions funded by the CIA. Of course, covert operations and proxy armies are not new weapons of the U.S. war machine. While they were pouring troops into Vietnam, the U.S. was also laying the ground for the CIA-backed overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile on 9/11/1973. But it is no longer possible due to objective conditions, the recession, defeats by national liberation struggles, and of course the turn of public opinion, for America to go sending troops storming through Yemen and Pakistan in a hunt for al-Qaeda militants. The objectives of war, on the other hand, have not changed. Empire building, expanding American influence through military domination, those remain the same. But the forms of war have had to change, and they've changed dramatically. It doesn't matter, really, whether it's Obama or Bush. The U.S. is the world's biggest military superpower, a position that is basically synonymous with war-making. Whoever sits at the helm of that ship cannot change the destination. He can only steer a new course towards it. So, how does the anti-war movement navigate this era of the hidden war? Well, we also have to change our tactics to fit these new conditions. The Anti-War Committee Chicago came out of the coalition that led the march against the NATO summit in 2012. I'm sure many of you were probably there. And it was actually the largest anti-war demonstration since Obama's inauguration. NATO, of course, functions as a junior partner in American imperialism. But while the demo was definitely against U.S. war-making, it also demanded money for jobs, education, healthcare, needs that were urgently felt, and still are, by many people in the grip of the recession. Since 2012, AWC has focused on a prominent symbol of war and occupation in our own city, the Boeing Company, headquarters downtown. Masquerading as an innocent airliner, Boeing makes billions as one of the world's biggest weapons manufacturers and as a major supplier of the Israeli military. So taking our cue from the BDS movement who have targeted Boeing, we also targeted its direct involvement in the civilian deaths and the siege on Gaza and tried to raise awareness about the so-called smart bombs or JDAM kits that they've developed for the IDF. Fighting another arm of U.S. imperialism, we've also joined forces with Anak Bayan as they campaign against the murderous Aquino government propped up by the U.S. military. And much closer to home, we've taken part in the fight against police crimes in Chicago, led by the CPAC campaign and the Black Lives Matter movement. From the military occupation of the Philippines to the police occupation of Black and Latino communities in the U.S., U.S. militarism and war-making knows no limits. And in the new era of covert warfare, our movement cannot afford to limit itself to opposing only the overt and obvious involvement or warfare. So we believe that the anti-war movement must unite with all forces struggling against militarism, occupation, and oppression. The fight to win peace is indivisible from the fight for a free Palestine, for community control of the police, for the end of a military dictatorship in the Philippines, and for jobs, healthcare, and education in America. And having said that, I'm deeply honored to be here with all of you today. And I look forward to hearing what these other wonderful panelists have to say. Thank you. All right. Thank you so much, Holly. Up next, our next speaker is Lorena Booney. Lorena Booney is from Anak Bayan, Chicago, a comprehensive national democratic mass organization for Filipino youth. Lorena will be speaking about militarization in the Philippines, specifically the militarization of the indigenous people. Everyone give it up for Lorena!
Hello, everyone. Usually I start my speeches off with chants, but today I would like to start my speech off with a thank you. Thank you and allowing me to speak on behalf of the militarized people of my country. So before I start, I just want to give you guys a heads up. The Philippines is actually really rich, okay? We have the fourth largest deposit of copper, fifth of nickel, and third of gold. And yet, the people are living in poverty. And according to a friend, Professor Robin Rodriguez from UC Davis, I'm going to quote her, "Filipinos are beggars on top of a mountain of gold." In the Philippines, because it's mostly agricultural, we claim that land is life. But the land that we live in, specifically in Mindanao, 500,000 hectares of land is now being mined, and 550,000 are being covered in plantations by foreign multinational corporations.
such as Monsanto, Dole, Xstrata,
Anglo-American. And basically, all these foreign companies have come to create a pillaging and the raping of my people's land. These plantations and mines are created by using the armed forces of the Philippines through the Investment Defense Force and other paramilitary elements to harass, incite violence, drive off Lumad communities from their lands, murder, and other plantations being built in the land of the people. There is land grabbing, and people are resisting that. And because of this resistance, there is a need to militarize the people so they would be driven off of their lands. And there is, in a sense, occupation that is happening in my country, in the island where I grew up in Mindanao. And this is backed by the U.S. military through AIDS and joint exercises. And recently, they're reopening the U.S. military base in the Philippines. 56% of the troops of the armed forces is actually stationed in the south. And so, because most of the natural resources that hasn't been taken out yet is in the south, is in Mindanao, most of the militarization that's happening is in the south. And there is this program called Upland Bayanihan, which is similar to COINTELPRO, which was used by the U.S. to counter the fight here in the United States, red tagging and all that. So to explain better the struggle of the indigenous people, I would like to let them speak. So here's a short video.
Resisting Spanish colonization and thus have maintained their indigenous belief systems, worldviews, and ways of life. Since that period to the present, they have been subjected to institutional discrimination and non-recognition of their right to self-determination. The development activities in indigenous lands are often carried out without the community's free, prior, and informed consent, as the law stipulates. These lead to serious human rights violations, with the long-term devastating effects of mining operations on the livelihood of indigenous peoples and the environment.
Kaming mga katutubo, yung mga ninuno namin, hanggang sa napunta sa taas-taasan ng bundokan ng Tapwa, katutubo ng Aita, para kaming aso na tinataboy kung saan-saan kami makapunta sa Robar. Tulad yun, nangyari nung nandito Amerikano, pinalipat-lipat din kami. Ngayon na naman, nawala Amerikano, kung saan-saan kami galing, pinataboy-taboy papunta sa bundok.
Pinalipat kami din sa lugar namin sa Bulo. Ngayon, dito namin kayong ililipat para meron kang ilaw, meron kayong tubig, ha? Meron eskwela, meron bahay. Saan ngayon?
Yung usapin ng diskriminasyon ay hindi mo na lamang makikita yan sa usapin ng pisikal na katayuan namin ng katutubo. Hindi na lamang doon sa usapin namin ng katutubo. Kami ay itim, kami ay kulot. Makikita mo yung usapin ng diskriminasyon nandun sa kapababayaan ng gobyerno.
Baka isuri-suri ka sundalo. Imbi-impi yung kapang mga umatiyang diyabot at kamanuho. Eh, bro, matukin yung katarabaw. Nagtapo pa yung siya yun. Eh, loko matarabaw ngay kumta, nakani katarabaw so, akarit mo yung kasundalo.
Through the years, indigenous peoples have struggled for the recognition and respect of their rights. However, indigenous resistance and protest are frequently encountered by military force, resulting to numerous human rights abuses.
So that's a short clip about the struggle of indigenous people in the South. Just last week, there was a recent attack in the land where I grew up in. This is particular in Surigao, northeastern Mindanao. Alcadev. Alcadev is a school that provides education and agricultural training for Manobo, which is a Lumad, in the south. The school believes that community development must start from securing the economy and livelihood of indigenous people. Before I move on, I would just like to give a disclaimer. Libertality is real, and we want to show that. So just give a heads up, it's going to make some people uncomfortable. So in the south, in September 1st, the Lumad leaders in the community of Surigao were found dead on September 1st, 2015. Mapaso chairperson and Kalumaran elected officer Dianel Campos was shot on the head by the Armed Forces Philippines-backed Maghahati Bagani paramilitary. These aren't part of the military, but they are being developed and trained by the Philippine forces. He was shot in front of his neighbors and his family. Alcadev Executive Director Emerito Samarca, he was stabbed, shot, and his throat was slit open by his assailants. He was the principal of the school. And finally, Datu Belo Senzo. Datu is the leader of a community, like one of the elders. He was shot 8 times. His body was found dead with his jaw crushed and both of his arms broken. Sorry, I'm getting a little emotional. Okay, so when asked what his response was to all these killings, the president of the Philippines said that there is no campaign to kill anybody. He has washed his hands off. He has not even condemned these killings. The current president's parents were against the dictatorship, if you remember martial law in the Philippines in the 60s, the 70s, in the 70s. His parents were against the dictatorship. However, this president allows for the continuation of the gross human rights violations experienced during martial law. This month was the declaration 43 years ago of martial law, but these human rights violations, such as extrajudicial killing, leaders being incarcerated, bombings of communities, forced evacuation, political prisoners, are still happening in his term. And he says he was for human rights. He has perpetuated the same extreme conditions of poverty and exploitation consistent with the characteristic of the corrupt landlord, big bourgeois comprador class. The school created a community for the Lumads. However, 87 schools, including Alcadev, have been attacked. This is similar to what happened in Mexico, in Ayotzinapa, where 43 indigenous students fought for their rights and were disappeared. We are pinpointing the Mexican government, however, need to also point out that they are ultimately protecting the U.S. interest. And 20,000 Lumads have been forcibly evacuated and because of the occupation of the land, of the ancestral land. This is similar to what's going on in Palestine, the occupation of Palestine that has forced the evacuation of thousands of Palestinians. And we are blaming the Israeli government, but again, they are there ultimately to protect U.S. interests in that area. And with the militarization even in this country, within the United States, where there is mass incarceration and police brutality. And with all of this, we have one similar common enemy, and so we have to come together as a strong force to fight against the same enemy. Just January of this year, $50 million of our taxpayers' money was sent to kill my people. You can see here the hand of U.S. imperialism and economic plunder through the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is supposed to be free trade, but we know what free trade looks like. And also the military presence of U.S. forces in the Philippines and military drones, which is why we are supporting the campaign of anti-war committee against Boeing. And this is indicative of the pivot to Asia, in which the current agenda of militarization is in Asia to face off with China and the Philippines, not just as an economic and fertile ground for economic plunder, it is also a strategic location to be a launching pad against their war to China. And so that is why there is a pivot to Asia, and in this particular case, the Philippines is going to be one of the biggest targets. And so this is the interest of the U.S. imperialist These wars, these agreements are not for the people. And so we all need, again, to come together and fight back. In July of 2015, we had International People's Tribunal, which exposed and opposed the injustices being done against the Filipino people and has built a community and solidarity for the Philippine national democratic struggle against imperialism, feudalism, and bureaucrat capitalism. And so, as a people coming together to fight oppression, we call on everyone to come together to support each other's struggle, and we would like to ask for your support. We are calling on the international community to not just support, but to rage with the Filipino people against the escalating violence brought by the armed forces of the Philippines. We demand that the United States cut all military aid to the Philippines. We are asking for your support. In the back, we have petitions. These schools that are being shut down, we are petitioning for these schools to be protected and to be maintained. A school for the Lumads. We are asking for you to join us in a unified statement against Anak Bayan is trying to organize a unified statement in support of the struggle. And we would like for you to join our campaign to call your representatives, to demand for them to stop sending U.S. military aid to the Philippines and instead allocate that tax money for us here, for education, for healthcare. And most importantly, we would like to call on, in solidarity, to mobilize for Razmia on October 14th to face off. She is the face of oppression and neoliberal policies, imperialism, and occupation. This challenges us to build closer ties and to link together our struggles. And so we would like to mobilize together in support of Razmia. To close it off, I would like to share one really short video. Sorry, it got too long. This is a short video I want to share with you about our fight, the people's fight, the Lumad's fight against militarization.
Kabilin, dipinsahan, dipinsahan, panaliptan.
Thank you.
All right. So thank you, Lorena. Lorena also mentioned mobilizing for Razmia and her appeals hearing on October 14th in Cincinnati. I have sign-up sheets that are going to go around. If you want to come out to Cincinnati, I think it's super important that not all of us in this room be there, but we bring people with us so that we show that we are standing strong for Razmia. So I'm going to hand these out. And this is so we can coordinate travel to Cincinnati. So our next speaker is going to be Sundas Dagash. Sundas is a member of the Chicago chapter of USPCN and a youth organizer with the Arab American Action Network. She is in her second year at St. Xavier University, and I am really excited to hear what she has to say. So everybody give it up. Thank you. Hello, everyone. I need like a stepping stool or something. My name is Sundas Dagash. I'm a 19-year-old youth activist and member of the Chicago chapter of the U.S.-Palestinian Community Network. USPCN addresses countless issues that Palestinians here, as well as in the homeland, encounter on a regular basis. USPCN organizes around issues in regards to boycotting companies that profit off Israeli occupation and colonization, as well as ending surveillance of Arab and Muslim communities.
We are also working on the current campaign in defense of Palestinian political prisoners. Addressing these three main issues is very crucial in order to change and improve the living conditions of the Palestinian people who live in the diaspora. In Palestine, abuse and violence undergone by the Israeli military has become a routine in the day-to-day lives of thousands of Palestinians. In this trend of injustice under the government or leading power going completely unquestioned is only reciprocated in areas around the world. Palestinians are still living under the terrible conditions of occupation and apartheid. Israel is constantly repressing Palestinians' rights in Palestine, and there is a direct relationship between the repression that exists there and the repression that exists in our community here as well. In regards to the surveillance and militarization here, for example, there is a link to the state of Israel's repression of the Palestinian people. Moreover, surveillance and international intervention are related to issues of policing and repression of for other communities as well, and particularly in terms of terrorism. While there are numerous examples that prove this, one example is the training that the head of local police departments receive. Local police departments go to Israel to be trained in military tactics, including population control, dispersing protests, and counterterrorism training. In Ferguson, Missouri, for instance, the Ferguson Police Department was trained by the State of Israel in these particular tactics. These tactics of repression were perfected by the Israeli military by constantly using them against the Palestinian people, and then brought back to the U.S. to be practiced on the occupied black nation here in the United States. Surveillance and policing also plays a key role in the repression of Palestinian activists. The case of Rasmia Ouda serves as a clear example of this. Rasmia is a renowned community leader who has dedicated four decades of her life now to the empowerment of Arab women, and especially Palestinian refugee women. Rasmia's main objective is to help Arab women empower themselves in their struggles against racism here in the U.S., and in the homeland as well. I would first like to give you a background story of Rasmia as a political prisoner and refugee. Born in the year 1947, Rasmia was exposed to the struggles and tribulations of colonization and occupation since birth. For she was born in a year after what has come to be known as the Year of the Great Catastrophe, or as we call it, the Nakba. 800,000 Palestinians were violently removed from their homes and forced to endure the harsh living conditions of living in exile and in refugee camps. Rasmia's story epitomizes the meaning of the Palestinian struggle. Rasmia was also a survivor of the 1967 expansion of Israel into the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and various other Arab lands by which we refer to as the Nakba. In the year 1969, Rasmia, along with 500 other Palestinians, was arrested in a massive sweep by the Israeli military. There, she was placed in an Israeli detention where she suffered sexual and physical torture at the hands of the Israeli military for a duration of 25 days. In order to stop the torture, she signed a false confession and was convicted in 1970 based solely on that false confession in the Israeli military court, a court by which convicts 99.7% of Palestinians. There, she spent 10 years in prison and was released in a prisoner exchange in the year 1979. It was during this same year that Rasmia testified to the United Nations of her physical and sexual torture at the hands of the Israelis and became to be known as the first Palestinian woman to publicly testify and disclose the use of systematic sexual violence against Palestinian women by the Israeli military. Shortly after her release, Rasmia was exiled to Jordan, where she completed her education in law. She eventually worked as a caseworker and organizer in the refugee camps of Jordan and Lebanon. Rasmia immigrated to the U.S. to help care for her father, who had fallen ill to cancer in the year of 1993. Okay. And shortly after his passing, Rasmiya made her way to Chicago in the year 2004 when she joined the AAAN and founded the Arab Women's Committee, which is a committee that consists of 600 immigrant women from various parts of the Arab world. This provides them with a safe political and social space to discuss racism, cultural challenges, and other issues that they encounter in the U.S. On October 22, 2013, Rasmiya was arrested in her home by the Department of Homeland Security. That same morning, she was indicted in federal court and charged with unlawful procurement of naturalization on answers that she gave on a 20-year-old's immigration application. We ask ourselves, why is it that the government is looking at a citizen application that is over 20 years old? The prosecution of Rasmiya clearly proves that Rasmiya is a target of a hunt to suppress anyone who is critical of U.S. support of Israeli crimes against the Palestinian population and is diligently organizing in the Arab and Palestinian communities. Rasmiya's story as a torture survivor and political prisoner is not the only one in the Palestinian community. According to Adamir, which is a prisoner rights association in Palestine, there are over 200 Palestinian prisoners being held in jails and detention centers without trial. There are 5,800 Palestinian political prisoners as well. Approximately 700 Palestinian children under the age of 18 from the occupied West Bank are prosecuted every year through Israeli military courts after being arrested, interrogated, and detained by the Israeli army. The most common charge against children is the throwing of stones, a crime that is punishable under the military law by up to 20 years in prison. Many Palestinian children even serve time in the same Israeli prisons and detention facilities as adults. Palestinian women prisoners are subjected to forms of psychological and sexual torture and ill treatment throughout their arrest and imprisonment. Various forms of violence occur, such as sexual assaults, sexual insults, beatings, threats, and body searches. These actions take place in order to have Palestinian women make confessions in order to get out of their abuse. Furthermore, the disparity in the severity of punishment between Israelis and Palestinians in the past and present cases, such as the case of Ali Dawabsha, a one-year-old boy who was burned to death by an Israeli settler and later whose parents died from their injuries, serves as a single example of the extreme injustice that currently exists in Palestine. The settler who committed this vicious crime is serving a measly six-month sentence, yet Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has the audacity to state that, and I quote, "I am shocked by the murder of Ali Dawabsha. This is a reprehensible and horrible act of terrorism in every respect. We are all aware that Ali and his family are not the only victims of such violent acts, but why would Netanyahu make a statement by which completely counters his own actions? Operation Protective Edge, for example, is when we witnessed Israel slaughter over 2,100 Palestinians over a duration of 51 days. In Gaza during the summer of 2014 under the leadership of Netanyahu. So is the killing of over 500 children during Operation Protective Edge alone therefore justified? Are these frequent massacres not examples of terrorism? While cases such as the Dawabsha case is one that happens too frequently in Palestine, the barbaric actions and impunity that Israel granted settlers goes to prove the racist practices of Israel. But had it not been for the endless amount of U.S. aid, Israel would not have the means to constantly massacre the Palestinians. However, the unified resistance forces in Gaza were able to hinder the military objectives of the Israeli military, who also have accessibility to the most advanced and sophisticated weaponry supplied by the U.S. Through their resistance and perseverance, the brave people of Gaza were able to establish to the world that the Israeli military is not invincible. For Israel was forced to commit massacres by shellings and bombings because even the most elite Israeli commando units could not succeed in ground combat when opposing the resistance in Gaza. here in America, the land that promises equal freedom and justice for all, serves only as a setting for members of the black community to be murdered by police or vigilante every 28 hours. Similarly, in the Philippines, activists disappear and are murdered by the Aquino government with absolute freedom from liability and the backing of the United States. It has become an accepted social circumstance that every ethnic, racial, political, or racial group in a community must stand alone to overcome their own struggles and fight their own battles. An issue that arises in the African-American community is solely an African-American issue. An Arab problem is dealt by strictly Arabs. Difficulties in the Filipino community must be solved only by the Filipinos. This mentality is extremely detrimental to our society, for the struggles by which each of these communities faced are completely intertwined and connected to the struggles of the others. The goals that we aspire to achieve as a community can only be done by working in solidarity with the other communities who wish to achieve a common goal. The struggles of so many across the globe are unified by the threat of tyranny and injustice. This unifying thread only serves to symbolize how struggles belong to no single body or group of people, but are obstacles that must be overcome by the global community. Thank you.
Okay. Frank Chapman is a field organizer for the Chicago office of the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. He was one of the leaders of the Chicago August 29th march opposing police crimes that had over 2,000 people participate. Everyone, give it up for Frank.
Thank you, comrades. What I've been listening to for the last few minutes is the crimes of imperialism, which have been going on all my life. I turned 73 years old today, but I've been seeing this since I was a child. Let me just ask a question before I get started. Is there anyone in here who believes that the United States government is not an imperialist government? Okay, evidently you all do. So that makes it easy to talk to you, because what we're talking about here is not just crimes perpetrated against the African American community, the Arab American community, Filipinos, but crimes perpetrated against oppressed people throughout the world, and it's by the same government, and it's been by this government and governments like this government over 500 years. This is nothing new, you know. The first slaves that were taken out of Africa were taken out of Africa in 1442 by the Portuguese, you know. 100 million people over a period of five centuries, you know. This is a Holocaust, you know, of proportions that it's hard to wrap your mind around. It's not like the 6 million Jews Holocaust. Not to minimize that. That was horrible. That was a war crime, also perpetrated by imperialists. But people of color on this planet have suffered inhumanities from white imperialist governments unlike anybody else. And it has created a psychological situation where a lot of people can't see what's really going on because they're blinded by racism. They're blinded by race. W.B. Du Bois said in 1905 that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. Was he just talking about black people? No. He said the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. He was talking about all of us. All of us. And, you know, when I was taking some notes when the sister was showing the piece about the Filipino people, and it says, move from one place to another. Now, we know about that, don't we? Move from one place to another. That's how my people got here. Move from one place to another. And what happens is this. The capitalist imperialist economy moves us around based on the exploitation of our labor and the exploitation of our resources. That's how we get moved around. That's how they do it, you know. And so thanks for putting that in the context for me. These young people have provided you with the factual information. I want to present some politics, you know. And the politics I'm going to present is the politics of struggle, because that's what we need to be engaged in here. I can talk about the fact that the number of black people in American prisons right now is slightly more than the number of black people who were enslaved in the United States in 1861. 4 million people, over 4 million. Does that alarm anybody? I mean, have we heard any statements coming from the Justice Department or coming from anybody in this country saying that's alarming? Is there anybody standing before the United Nations accusing this country of gross human rights violations just by this very fact alone? No, because these are accepted practices on the part of imperialist governments throughout the world. They're having a big immigration problem right now in France, you know, and in different parts of Europe, right? You know, so these problems are going on everywhere. Who's going to do something about them? Who's going to do something about them? Is it going to be the governments? You know, are the governments going to do anything about it? Is the United States government going to suddenly see the light and cease and desist in the prosecution of Rasmia? I don't think so. I don't think we're going to suddenly see the light and do nothing. It's the people. It's the people. The people have to be organized in a struggle against these practices, against these governments. It's not going to happen any other way. If we're waiting on politicians to do something for us, it's not going to get done. What they're going to do is what they've been doing, you know. So the onus is on us, you know. And it's always been like that. It's always been like that. When the Civil War was going on, it didn't turn around until they gave the slaves guns. You know, when the slaves got guns and they said, okay, now you can go kill your master. You know, it was pretty much a done deal then, right? So that's the way it goes, you know. I just want to speak to a couple of things that I think are important in terms of how we express our solidarity with the Palestinian people, the Filipino people, and all oppressed people, you know. And that is that whenever we engage in our struggles, we act out that solidarity, like we did on the 29th of August. It's not a theory, you know. We were there. You were there, you know. We were there together. United action. United. We may not all get on the same page in terms of ideas. We may not all get on the same page in terms of just how the tactical style of struggle should be in any given moment. But we got to all be on the same page when it comes to fighting the fascist, racist policies of this imperialist system. We got to all be on the same page on that one, you know, because it's murdering us one at a time. So if we don't all get together, we'll hang separately, you know. And so this is what I think the message of all this is. This is what I think the message of the last speaker was, you know, that we got to unite and fight back. We got to unite. Therein lies our strength. It can't, separately, we can be defeated. United, we can never be defeated. During the, I don't know if you guys remember Chile and what happened with Salvador Allende and all of that, you know. But, you know, you read books. but there was a slogan that the Chilean people developed during this period. And it was, the people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated. The people united will never be defeated. That's real. That's real. That's real. That's real. And that's what we got to make real today. You know, that's what we got to make real in these struggles today. The National Alliance Against Race and Political Repression has always been a multiracial, multinational organization. We've always reached out a hand of solidarity to the Palestinian people from the day that we were born back in 1973. You know, we reached out a hand of solidarity to the people in South Africa in 1973. You know, we've never been confused about this. We've never been confused about this. You know, and we've gotten victories. We've gotten victories. We just recently freed a brother who had 40 years in prison because the police, after having shot him, what, 28 times, said that he was the villain, okay? How did we free him? We got 40,000 people to sign a petition. You guys in this room helped us do it. 40,000 people to sign a petition. And Brother Redmond here and some other great legal minds who we have on our side, you know, fashioned the petition for pardon, and we got him out. See, the people united can do the impossible. It just takes longer.